Hey friends, it's Eric Swanson, co-host of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, here with a special announcement. And that announcement is that 30 Minutes in the New Testament can now be found on YouTube. If you click on the link in the show notes here just below me, you're going to see that we have our own YouTube page. And the reason we're doing that is because from now on, we're going to be recording not just audio of the episodes, which will continue on the various podcast platforms that you use, but we're also going to film our episodes so that you can access video. And so make sure to click on that link, subscribe today so you can keep up with all the clips we release and all our future episodes. Thanks so much.
Hello and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. This is Wade here in the podcast studio, joined by my dear friend and colleague, the Reverend Professor Jason Oakland, resplendent in his green jacket. What would you call that? A fleece?
Yeah, a sweater.
That he has fished for compliments on since he got it this. Was it late last semester or early this semester?
Late last semester, I think, yeah.
So that's the first time I've said something positive about
it. That's true, yeah.
I wanted that moment to be special.
Yes.
So it will live on.
Yep.
Whenever someone listens to this podcast.
Right.
Okay.
It means a lot.
We are without the Reverend Dr. Michael Berg, who is doing college professor stuff. He is our fearless leader. He is our department head. Mm-hmm. He's the big guy, the main guy.
Yep.
And so he's doing department stuff.
He's
and
the
since we are just peasants.
Right.
We are bureaucratic peasants.
Yep.
And we just do what we're told.
Right.
We plant the theological potatoes.
Yep.
And then we dig them up. Yep. And we make like a shepherd's pie without meat because we're peasants.
Right, yeah.
But so we were free this hour, and we are coming right off Easter break. And so we thought we'd record an episode. We're going to record hopefully one or two more on Thursday because we are the new, more faithful Let the Bird Fly that is trying to get back to weekly episodes and to stick to like 35 to 40 minutes or so with each episode. And so that's why we are here doing our due diligence. And today we're going to be talking, we'll come up with that episode title, but something maybe like the spirit of Lutheranism. Because Jason.
Yeah.
As you might have heard, let me get ready for this. Jason is I gotta go back. I should have been more prepared with this. Jason, what are you doing right now?
I'm taking my graduate school courses.
So, as you guys might have heard in previous episodes, Jason is in grad school.
Yes, I am.
And he has a couple master's degrees, so that's nice.
Yeah.
Right, but he is working on his PhD.
Yes.
Or his D of PH, or
yes,
doctorate of philosophy,
right.
So I think it'd be the latter, not the former. You're gonna get to use fancy phrases like that, as you continue in grad school.
I can't wait.
But Jason has been working on a lot and may write a dissertation on. He's not quite to where he has to nail this down for sure, right? When you got your prospectus,
I think it'll be next year, end of next year, maybe.
Okay.
So I think I'm about a year away.
He's got a little bit of time, but he's been working on this. A man named Bugenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to name a dog that, so I can call him Boogie.
Boogie.
Who was Luther's pastor.
Yeah.
And a notorious adiaphorist.
Yes, notorious.
And I've studied, the person I study most often is Matthias, I'm going to say him the Wisconsin way. Matthias Flacius Illyricus, or Matthias Flacius Illyricus, who also taught in Wittenberg, like Bugenhagen did, and was a student of Luther and Melanchthon, as Bugenhagen was a colleague of the two, and was not a notorious adiaphorist.
But does have.
But did have some notoriety.
Yes.
Mostly because he was tragically misunderstood.
Tragically, yes. Understandable. Yeah. Yep. Understandably misunderstood with tragic consequences.
But what I thought we could talk a little bit today about then is the spirit of Lutheranism, right? What is it, like these early personalities that play an important role in the proclamation of the gospel happening clearly and loudly mm-hmm. again in Germany and in Europe. What is the spirit of Lutheranism? And partly in mind of, I think especially young people and seminarians and others pick up on these things, right? You want to be like Luther or be like these other people, and there can be things that become imitative that maybe aren't connected to the gospel or to the scriptures, but they can be something that maybe we imbibe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jason's drawn to Bugenhagen somewhat temperamentally.
Yeah.
And I think I'm drawn to Flacius temperamentally somewhat as yeah. well. So that's what we will be discussing without Michael.
Right.
Although we would have to give him a reformer.
Yeah, maybe he just transcends all temperaments. I don't know.
It would be difficult. Yeah.
It would be.
Maybe he would be like our Chemnitz.
Could be, yeah.
He reconciles us.
Yeah. Yeah. Could be.
He likes the liturgy.
He does? Yeah. Got a nice beard, mm-hmm. you know, so.
That could be.
And it works.
Yeah. But lest we go too long, we are part of the 1517 Podcasting Network. Encourage you to go to 1517.org, check out all the good stuff there. And Jason, as we make our way to the main topic, would you mind giving us our disclaimer?
This show doesn't speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us. We'll be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy skepticism, because, well, as a responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you were listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
And that brings us again to our main topic, which, why don't we go with for now, the spirit of Lutheranism.
Okay.
The thought is we can talk a little bit, what is a Lutheran spirit, right? Luther says of Zwingli, I believe, mm-hmm. he is of a different spirit, right?
Yep.
What is that temperament? Is that disposition? Is that methodology? What exactly is it? And I think if we discuss it in the light of, first, the beginnings of the Reformation, maybe up until the Augsburg Confession, where we have these people uniting in the confession of the gospel, and then as we see it in the years after Luther's death, up until the Formula of Concord, and I would say pretty much all of Lutheran history that follows plays on certain themes, mm-hmm. spirits,
yep.
Dispositions, emphases that we already see earlier. You might say, well, what about like a rationalism? I suppose that would be some of the academic disposition that you might see. And so maybe we can begin by just giving a little background on the men we study.
Sure.
Would that be fair? Would you like to go first or second? Yours is first chronologically. As far as Reformation-wise.
But if you want to go first, that way okay. I'll kind of know the...
Because mine plays a role in
yeah.
things popping off.
Yeah, okay. yeah, yep.
So when we're talking about Matthias, Flacius, Illyricus, or Flacius...
I much prefer Flacius.
But. My dissertation committee, there was three big camps on how to say his name.
Really?
And so I just kept rotating to try to please everyone. Because there's, if you know something about me, Jason,
you're
I'm a people pleaser.
You're a pleaser.
Right, yeah. And that, so I was working the room.
Yes.
But Flacius was a Croatian. Now, Croatia wasn't a thing then. That was part of the Venetian kind of sphere of influence. But he ends up, long story short,
which is where the Illyricus comes from.
Right, exactly. And he ends up making his way north. He has some influences that have him go that way after having studied in Venice. He's trained as a humanist. He's going to make his way north. He's going to have stops in places like Augsburg and Basel and Tübingen, and et cetera. Finally makes his way to Wittenberg, studies there, especially focusing on Hebrew. This is where he and I have our great parting. Hebrew was a great thorn in my flesh.
Yeah.
I don't know if you enjoyed Hebrew. It was by far my least favorite language I've ever studied. I see why God used it.
Yep.
But, boy, I'm glad that he switched to Greek eventually. But studied Hebrew, does well with the recommendation of some of his teachers, especially a man named Philip Melanchthon, with whom Flacius lived for a while. He ends up becoming a Hebrew professor. And when you have the death of Luther and then the defeat of the Schmalkaldic League, now you can go back to our Life of Luther Winging It series, which ended up being like 70 or 80 sessions instead of 12. And you can listen to more on all of this. If you go to the website, you go to Winging It, it's all there. And we really enjoyed it.
Right.
But you can go back and if you want to learn more about these things. But the emperor is victorious. And he tries to force this re-Catholicizing agenda, this formula, Augsburg Interim, upon the Lutheran territories and churches. And that's just not going to work in Saxony, where Moritz, who was also a Lutheran, had sided with the emperor to kind of overthrow his cousin and gets his title and some of his lands. And Moritz says, we need to come up with some sort of compromise formula that will keep the emperor happy but not have my subjects overthrow me, right? They're already calling me the Judas of Meissen. I don't like that.
Yeah, that's not a good look.
We got to do something. And Melanchthon and others will participate in this in Leipzig and come up with what gets called this proposal, which Flacius, in a propaganda coup, gets called the Interim, the Leipzig Interim, associating it with what happened in Augsburg. And this is a compromising formula. And those who participated, the Wittenberg faculty members, say we only compromised on so-called adiaphora. Now, when I became a Lutheran, and I went up to my alma mater, Martin Luther College, this is a word I'd never heard before. Mm. And I heard it often.
Yeah.
I think they teach Lutherans this like in 4K, you know, they're even in the grade school.
I think you're right.
And often it was used, I would say, to justify someone's preferences for something, right? Or their ability to do something that maybe someone else questioned them about. Sometimes used even like a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right.
This is an adiaphron. Adiaphora being plural, adiaphron singular. Flacius and the Gnasio Lutherans, which means genuine Lutherans, which we don't know exactly how that term, who coins it. It could have been mocking them. Oh, they think they're the real Lutherans. It could have been them emphasizing this is what real Lutheranism is. They say this stuff's not adiaphora, and it's not adiaphora especially because you're saying we have to do it. The state is saying the church has to do it. And if you say we have to do it and we have to do this to be Christians, well, then it ceases to be adiaphora. The Wittenbergers say, no, man, it's just adiaphora. You got to calm down. And this leads to what's called the adiaphoristic controversy, which then leads to 3 decades of controversies about good works, doctrine justification, scripture, free will, original sin, where Flacius gets a little misunderstood. All sorts of these different debates come out of that. And so what you end up with is kind of this Wittenberg school of thought. And many times some of these people get labeled Philippists, which sometimes is fair, sometimes isn't. Because often they're holding positions that Philip himself did not hold. They think they're sticking up for Philip, but they're going on beyond things he held. And then you have these Gnasio Lutherans. They eventually will be especially centered in Jena in Germany, which is what makes the University of Jena one of the most interesting universities ever, because it went all the way from Gnasio Lutherans to communists.
Yeah.
To Marx, you know. it's seen some characters.
Yeah. Covers the whole spectrum.
Their alumni get together would be interesting if you could do it across the centuries.
It would.
And so the Gnasio Lutherans, McCulloch in one of his histories calls them Lutheran Ayatollahs. I've always found that interesting. And from an English Reformation perspective, I can see how he gets there. You know, they're actually arguing against the state imposing doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of the Ayatollah thing, I don't know.
Doesn't quite carry.
But they get caricatured at least as being very zealous, very, I won't say hyperbolic, but very blunt, very, mm-hmm. They really push the boundaries on anything Luther emphasized. They're gonna stick with this. They see these things as being definitive for what it is to be Lutheran. And then the Philippists, fairly or unfairly, and the Wittenbergers, and again, I don't like calling the Wittenbergers Philippists.
Mm-hmm.
That comes later.
Right.
They get characterized as being kind of the more moderate, middle road, you know, kind of Lutherans. And then you're going to get the Formula of Concord, where we will get, like, the forerunner of our good friend, the Reverend Dr. Michael Berg,
yep.
Martin Chemnitz,
yep.
and others, who try to come up with a formula that speaks faithfully to God's word, but avoids the pitfalls, the ditches that people have fallen into on one side or another by going beyond what Scripture says and emphasizing something. One of those people who ends up having that done in that regard is Flacius.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But so when we think of Flacius, often Jim Nestigan had a great line where he said once, and he was talking to me, and he knew I was doing Flacius stuff, and he said, he just seems like the kind of guy that would walk in a room and say, tell me what you're wrong about. You know, another person, right, asked me once, do you think, and he didn't mean this in a derogatory way, do you think he could have been on the spectrum?
Mm.
Right? And what they meant is his ability to be, like, highly technical and brilliant,
yep.
but really fixate on something, you know, and sometimes not read the room well to get the cues of, like, okay, it'd be better to proceed slowly.
Yep.
And so that this kind of spirit of Flacius, Bente's work, which was included in the Green Book, the Triglotta, that many pastors used historically in the Missouri Synod and in the Wisconsin Synod as part of their training. Bente's Flacius is in most instances the white cowboy hat guy.
Yep.
And Melanchthon is the black hat.
Yep.
Or Melanchthonians are. And so I think a lot of people over the years have come through and thought, yeah, this is the Lutheran spirit. Not only the rough edges of Luther and his polemics, but kind of this Flacian, like, okay, we're gonna have at it, almost to the point of looking for a fight, right?
Yep.
And so I think that covers one potential spirit of Lutheranism. And I would say there's a reason I was historically attracted to that. I don't know, Jason, if you've ever picked up on this in our relationship, but I can sometimes fixate, and I can sometimes be looking for what's wrong.
Yeah.
And I can sometimes have opinions about it that I share, and I can sometimes do so with a little bit of maybe stinging mockery. Would that be fair to say?
No, I'd say that's fair. Yep.
But also with, I like to think, tinged with love.
Tinged with love.
With love.
And and in a not unwinsome way at times.
Thank you. So, I appreciate that.
Right, yeah.
So why don't you, and so I would say, this is going to be kind of a spirit of Lutheranism you're going to see in the age of Orthodoxy somewhat,
mm-hmm.
In the relationship with Calvinists. The most vocal people in opposing Calvinists are definitely going to kind of have this disposition. Now, some will become crypto-Calvinists and have the opposite.
Right.
But I would say in later years, and especially when we live in a more ecumenical world, Lutheran World Federation, whatever, that spirit is very unpopular spirit. Right. That that's part of the reason if you read modern treatments of Flacius, depending on the author, sometimes they just have no time for him because they see him as being this antiquated,
yep.
just wants to fight, which I don't think is fair.
Right.
But Bugenhagen maybe serves well as an example of this other spirit. He's Luther's pastor, which was not an easy job.
No.
He is also teaching.
Yep.
He's responsible when the Reformation spreads, they send Bugenhagen. Yeah. And he's going to help set up how the Kirchenordnungen, how are the churches going to work in these places? How are they going to operate?
He's the organizer.
Yeah, there's a lot of world Lutheranism that in one way can trace itself back. I believe, I could be wrong. So our brothers in the Evangelical Lutheran Synod, mm-hmm. our brothers and sisters, don't rebuke me if I'm wrong, but I believe in their hymnal, which I believe is called the Evangelical Lutheran Hymnary.
Yes.
They have the Bugenhagen service.
They do, yeah.
Okay. Yep. So I'm not wrong on that, right? So this is a very important influence as well. So I'll go ahead and toss it to you, Jason.
Yeah,
you see what I'm doing?
Oh, yep.
And I'm tossing it accurately like the undefeated ALC Central first place Tigers relief pitcher. Boom.
Boom.
Yep.
Boom. Yeah. Twins started good, but they've stumbled a little. The last game was ugly, that's for sure. But, hey.
It happens.
It does happen. So Bugenhagen is a Pomeranian, so that's on the north side of Germany there, right along the sea coast there to the north. And he is drawn to reform early, but he is much more of a, you know, church reformer in the sense of morals, in the sense of maybe some, you know, organizational things. He's not a theological reformer early on. And he, you know, goes to school, and he...
Did he go to grad school, Jason?
Not right away. In fact...
Have you gone to grad school, Jason?
I have, yes. I'm still in process, actually.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, making my way through.
All right, go ahead. He continues his education.
But he actually... gets a job offer as a teacher and leaves to kind of be the principal of a school. And in serving the school, he makes such an impression and things go really well at the school that the people in the town say, we'd really like you to be our pastor. And he doesn't necessarily have theological training at that point. Which is not uncommon, right?
This is before kind of, there are people, pastors, who have a lot of theological training.
Yeah.
But this is before the growth of seminaries.
Yes. And he has demonstrated a solid working knowledge of the scriptures. He's an able administrator. He can teach people. People are it wasn't just, he had people from the town, from the nearby monastery that were coming and sitting in on his lessons at the school to hear him teach the scripture. So, I mean, this is they recognize an ability there and, you know, a love for the scriptures. And he takes on this, he becomes the priest in the town. And he's also given the opportunity to open a school in connection with the monastery a little bit farther down the road. And it's in this time where he gets connected with some of Luther's writings. And at first, he's not real impressed. He thinks this guy might be the greatest heretic in all of Christendom at the first glance. And then he does a careful study of it. And I believe he's dealing with the Babylonian Captivity of the Church is the first one that he's... reading from Luther, and he's like, this guy gets it where so many have not for so long. And it's shortly after that, he corresponds with Luther a little bit, but shortly after that, he goes to Wittenberg to now actually do some of that continued schooling. He's 35 years old, which there too I can...
I was just going to jump in. Yeah.
Going back to school, I can appreciate that a little bit. But he goes to be a student, but it's not long where people have kind of heard about, you know, hey, this guy's got a knack for teaching the scriptures. And fellow students start coming to ask him to explain some things. He kind of starts having, you know, a private study group, which grows into like a small lecture. Then you have... like Melanchthon comes and sits in and is like, hey, you should be doing this more. And so he kind of becomes an unofficial faculty member.
Which is to Melanchthon's credit.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll let you get back to it just a moment. But I do think this is important to be fair to Melanchthon. We won't talk to him a lot about him in this episode, but Melanchthon's really good at taking people under his wing and mentoring them.
Yes.
He does this with Flacius. He does this with Bugenhagen. He does this with a lot of people.
Does it with Chemnitz.
Right. He often gets painted as like the not enough personality to be the head of the Reformation, that he's not Luther. But I think in daily interaction, in many ways, Philip's personality did more than Martin's as far as for grooming. I should say grooming nowadays. That gets used in a bad way.
Right.
For mentoring future pastors and teachers. Sorry for jumping in there.
No,
I do think that is an important connection point that they both have this experience.
Yep, they do. And the other interesting thing is that he gets to Wittenberg just at the time pretty much when Luther is heading to the Diet of Worms. And so Luther is away.
I believe it's the Diet of Worms.
Diet of Worms.
He said Diet of Worms, right?
No, I said Worms.
Oh, then I'm going to say Diet of Worms.
Diet of Worms. Gotcha.
That is now my pronunciation.
Okay, I'll go with that. But that means Luther's going to be gone not only for that diet, but for the captivity in the Wartburg or whatever, you know, for how long after. And there are some things that are blowing up in Wittenberg at this time, too. And not only is Bugenhagen, you know, started to teach a little bit, he becomes a stabilizing voice alongside of Melanchthon and a couple others that are trying to keep things from going off the rails. And that's noticed as well by not only Melanchthon, Luther takes note, and a few others. And so when the city parish is vacant a couple years later, because the pastor there kind of, it's a rather sudden death, he is elected to take over as the pastor at the city church, and becomes pretty instrumental in, you know, the practical implementation of the Reformation in Wittenberg. As you said, you know, he serves as Luther's confessor and pastor, and which is a significant contribution in its own right, you know, to, because
Luther avails himself of pastoral care.
You know, and he very much appreciates,
suffers with depression.
Yep.
Or melancholy, as they would have called it then.
Right.
He wasn't an easy person to pastor.
Right. And he comes to rely upon that, you know, voice of counsel and sees Bugenhagen's counsel and comfort as from Christ himself. After he's been doing this, he's been the pastor there about 5 years when they start getting these requests to say, hey, we want to implement the Reformation in some of these other places. Can you send someone to help us? And he is involved in that. And he's one of the first ones that goes out and goes out more so than the others, produces more church orders, Kirchenordnungen, than the others that are involved. You know, other people are doing this, Melanchthon, Jonas, you know, a few of the other guys. But Bugenhagen does it the most and becomes what he's known for, is not only the, you know, pastor in Wittenberg and, you know, Luther's spiritual confessor in that regard, a Seelsorger in that regard, one who cares for the soul, but he's known for organizing the church and spreading that Reformation message across, and most of the work that he's doing is to the north because he knew the language that, you know, they spoke a little bit of a different dialect up there, so he went north, and including an invitation to go outside of the empire to Denmark, which also included Norway at the time. And so he's influential in Scandinavian countries as well. And as we get, and remains a not only a pastoral advisor for Luther, counselor for Luther, but is a personal friend. I mean, he's Luther's friend. Their wives get along. Their families, similar ages, they get along, and is an important...
It'd probably be like my family and Michael's family.
Right, yes. Yeah,
see exactly. What I did there?
Yeah, I did see that. Yes, I did notice that.
Was there a sting in that?
Right, a little bit. A little bit.
I was hoping you thought I'd say you.
I was going to say
I do like Carrie. I like Carrie and I like Elizabeth.
Right, yeah.
I want to make that perfectly clear.
Yeah, exactly, right. So, and then, but then as things get, and this is where I think you see Bugenhagen is fiercely loyal to Luther. And I think that's one of the things that as his later life unfolds and as Luther's death and the events that take place after that, Bugenhagen is, he's a force of stability, and he's a very loyal person. And part of, I think, when things start to go sideways after Luther's death, and you have these conquests and interims and all these other things, and this is something that I'm kind of surprised that there isn't more on Bugenhagen and his role in that in English. I've been looking for different things for a while, and I haven't found a ton of material on, you know, Bugenhagen after Luther's death, in English at least. So, so this is one where I'm not maybe as well read as I could be on this, but it seems like he, in loyalty to Luther, he also feels a loyalty to the institution of the university in Wittenberg,
right?
And feels that if we need to get this going again, we need to this needs to if that doesn't go, the Reformation might just crumble and fall. And then I think he also is very personally loyal to Philip Melanchthon as well, and he sees some of those attacks coming against Melanchthon, you know, feels like he needs to respond in some ways to that. The other thing I think that goes along with this, which speaks to the spirit to a degree, is when he writes, he is not a guy that necessarily names names. I mean, he will point things out. He will you know, call...
You know whose name he does name?
Yeah, he does. He and Flatius get into a little bit.
He likes to name him.
Yeah, he does. He does name him, but he for the most part, you know, either he won't respond directly, or if he does respond, it'll be, you know, much more not as pointed or name naming in most cases. And then the other thing I think that we notice with Bugenhagen during this time, which, I mean, is consistent beforehand as well, but the concern for the people under his care,
right,
that he takes very seriously, you know, I've been called to serve these people with the gospel here, and this is, I need to do what I can so that I can continue to serve the people here, and I think, you know, part of it, this is one of those things, too, I think, that is challenging for us to maybe appreciate, is that, you know, how do you navigate some of those where this is all happening rather quickly and on the fly? I mean, I think in some ways, you know, we might be sympathetic to that, like the way some of the COVID things happen, like just like that, you know, you have you know, courts have ruled this way, or the governor makes this proclamation or whatever, and now...
Jason had his gun, and I had to be like, calm down.
Right, calm down. Yeah, but, you know, where all of a sudden, you know, this happens, this is now the reality, and how are you going to respond? And, you know, sometimes looking back on that, say, maybe should we have done that differently, or was...
Yeah.
You know, I think that's something that we have to recognize and appreciate, too, in this, is to say that, you know, these guys were trying to do the best that they could in very challenging circumstances. But I think you see that care for souls. I think you see that loyalty for friends.
Except for Flacius.
Yeah, except for Flacius, yep. But I think Bugenhagen would say, I was just trying to respond to what was said originally. But yeah, so I think that's kind of the I think that's maybe what, I don't know if there's anything more specifically.
No, and I think what I would say to like bridge, I think help bridge this too is, I think something to keep in mind if we're going to take these four people, Luther, Flacius, Bugenhagen, Melanchthon, Luther and Bugenhagen were ordained.
Yeah.
Luther and Bugenhagen both served as pastors.
Yes.
Flacius and Melanchthon, not ordained, which doesn't mean bad. Both lay theologians.
Yep.
And so primarily classroom and church administration, university administration.
Yep.
Roles. And so I would say that out of the four of those people, Bugenhagen is the most gifted churchman.
Yeah.
And that's maybe something we don't talk about enough in our own day is churchmanship used to be a thing you just expected of.
Right.
Of clergy. And I think it got a bad rap because it came to be associated eventually, churchmanship with like just not holding any convictions but being about the institution.
Yep.
And I think that's not what I mean with Bugenhagen.
Right.
But we do have this question that arises then in these difficulties from the initial emergence of Lutheranism into these times of conflict of what is the relationship to the institution? What is the institution?
Right.
And I think that's where sometimes Flacius gets a bad rap of being anti-institution, which he's not. It pains him to have to oppose people in Wittenberg. He wants to found schools and universities. And I think sometimes Bugenhagen can be painted as slavish to the institution, which again is not fair,
right?
Because he's worried about the souls there, and this yep. is where called workers are going out from.
Yeah,
you know, this is where the Reformation began. This is where Luther's buried, right? This is clearly an important thing. And so I think, so we've got about 5 minutes, and so I think we've given two views of two people who are not Luther or Melanchthon,
right?
And these spirits that get imbibed, and so. In the biography I have that's going to be coming out soon, next year in the Flacius year, the 450th anniversary of his entry into heaven, which will be 2025, 1575 he dies.
Gotcha.
And I note in there that I notice in myself, and I think it's just, common, especially in the churches of the synodical, former synodical conference, to have your phase in college and seminary where you're studying Lutheran, early Lutheran history, where you don't want to be the pietist. So if I can just use this as an example, and I use this in the biography. And so you're going to be not the pietist, and how do you be not the pietist? By being an even bigger pietist. Right? So you're going to have a cigar because you're not a pietist. Well, that's the most pietist thing you can do because you're not just having a cigar because you like cigars.
Right.
But you're like having a cigar as a statement of your theological and state of sanctification. Right? You're taking a stand.
Yeah.
Which is not much different than not playing cards or dancing.
Yep.
Or buying insurance or anything like that. And I think we can be tempted to imbibe this with the spirit of Lutheranism as well. And you mentioned the Scandinavians, and this discussion we're having is very much rooted in the German Reformation. Because the experience of those who come out of church bodies rooted in Scandinavia are not going to have these bitter battles as early on as becomes kind of definitive for those who come from German Lutheranism, which is what the Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod
right.
do. And so you can have, even within our own history, people that you look at and you want to know, are they Luther or Melanchthon? Are they Bugenhagen or Flacius? And I think a healthy thing for us to consider, to remember as Lutherans, is A, none of these people were as cut and dry as it seems. There were times when Luther was willing to back off because he wasn't sure enough of something to take the stand to say, no, you the question of resistance is a big one.
Yeah.
And Torgau, right? Yeah. And there's times where Melanchthon's very bold. He could have bailed on Wittenberg early on. He stays on that train. He opposes the Augsburg Interim. And so I think it's interesting with these two men to just think of, well, what does it mean to be a Lutheran? And I think if you ask people, well, what do you associate with Lutherans, it would depend where the world you're in, right? But I think a good number of people, in the States at least, would either, if they're associated with the biggest denomination, probably considered a progressive, open-minded, whatever. But if they had encountered historically, the churches of the former Synodical Conference would probably think, well, it's alphabet soup. They're, you know, always criticizing other religious groups, you know, this, that, you name the caricature. And that caricature would probably be more fallacious. And so I think it's kind of like the apostles. If you look at the 12 apostles, well, whose spirit should the church take on more? Well, it depends where and in what age. Sometimes Peter's putting his foot in his mouth. Sometimes you need Peter, to take the bold stand.
Yeah.
And so we've mostly been, this has been a very self-indulgent episode. We've each talked a lot about someone that we enjoy studying. But I do think maybe as we're, we've come out of the Luther year, it's now 7 years behind us. As you're teaching the Luther class now and as I've taught it, something you grow an appreciation for as you study it more is this is really a movement of a circle of friends. This is not just Luther or Luther and Melanchthon. And to think about the various people that contributed and what we can glean from them. And I don't think any of them would be thrilled if the spirit we took away was a caricature.
Right.
Of that I'm going to be combative like Flacius, or I'm going to be polemical like Luther, or I'm going to be academic and open-minded like Melanchthon, or I'm going to be, a churchman, meaning, preserve institution at all costs like Bugenhagen. Yep. But that really the spirit of Lutheranism is the Holy Spirit, hopefully.
Yeah.
And the preaching of the gospel and how each of them had to wrestle to figure out what that meant in that circumstance and how they would navigate that in their circumstances. And maybe as we find ourselves in a very challenging age for the church now, for the Lutheran church at least. I mean, what is the Lutheran church today? There's so many different groups,
right?
Such a variety of theology, that we remember that that needs to be the case in our day and age too. I was talking to someone not too long ago, and the best answer I had ultimately for some of these things that they were wrestling with is we don't get to live the Christian life not in tension. That's the only way you can live it. And Paul writes about this again and again.
Yep.
And so, what is the spirit of Lutheranism as far as a disposition, a tendency, a personality? That has to be lived, I think, in tension as well. I'll give you the closing words. We're right around 40 minutes. And so we got to be the new improved, let the bird fly. But
disciplined. Yeah, gotcha.
I'm going to unmute myself, and you're going to say whatever you're going to say, and then you're going to say let the bird fly, and then I'll play the music.
Okay. The other thing I think you're talking about the circle of friends thing and stuff like that is this idea of, how...
It's like Michael and Joel and I.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. And I said I was going to mute. I'll mute myself again.
Remember, discipline. But this idea of, you highlighted a number of different gifts and stuff that they have, and yet I think how each of them contributed, and I think that is something... for all of us to keep in mind that, the Lord has gifted us in certain ways. We're all unique in that regard, and yet there's a place to serve, and those gifts are needed. That isn't just in, a Reformation movement. That's in a congregation, that's in a family, that's in, any number of different places where, you're called to live and called to serve. And so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind too, that when you're talking about this, spirit of Lutheranism, which again, guided by the Holy Spirit, but incorporates, these different men with all their strengths as well as weaknesses. That's something for us to keep in mind too, that, hey, God has a place, to use us as well. And when he calls us to do that, I guess, what can you do? But let the bird fly.
That wasn't bad. I thought you were going to say something a lot dumber.
Yeah? Well, good. I'm glad I...
You can be in our circle of friends, too.
Okay, good.
See how I said earlier? Yeah. I like to poke fun.
Yes.
But with love.
Yeah, right.
You can be in the circle of friendship.
In a winsome way. Yeah. So... I did notice that I wasn't included with, you know, you and Mike and Joel, though.
That was awesome, yeah.
At first.
That's what I'm saying, now you can be in.
Oh, well, that's good, yeah, so.
As long as you behave.
Can't make any promises.